The following program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.
Coming up next, a program featuring Meredith Monk and her seminal 1976 theatrical work, Quarry. You will hear an interview conducted by Charles Ruas with the artist in 1976. Our thanks to Meredith Monk and the House Foundation for making this material available.
Audio Experimental Theater. This is Charles Ruas introducing the Audio Experimental Theater. For this program, Meredith Monk has adapted her opera Quarry for broadcast. Meredith Monk is both a composer and a choreographer. In her performance and singing, she has explored the uses of multimedia. For the listener who hasn't seen Quarry, what do you think that they're going to sort of miss?
You're getting the sound score. I mean, you're getting the sound.
Yeah.
The sound had its own integrity. I mean, it's like a soundtrack in a film. And the piece is put together musically. I mean, even visually it's put together musically, and sound-wise it's put together musically. I mean, the structure of it is musical, basically it's a musical structure.
Is it a musical structure or a dance structure?
I think of it as, well, I mean, a choreographic structure and a musical structure is not that different. It's just one is visual and one is sound, oral.
Yes.
And still the same concept rather than, say, a dramatic structure. Conceptually, you know, a choreographic structure or a musical structure, in a sense, have the same qualities. You know, rather in opposition to, say, a more dramatic, theme and variation structure or a, theme, climax, denouement, play
yes.
structure.
But with you, there's not much of a separation between the choreography and the musical
no.
element,
Mm-mm.
particularly.
Well, as I keep on going along, I keep on trying to... somehow work them to, try to think of them as one continuum and try to work with the relationships between the sound and, I keep on dealing more and more with the relationships between the visual, the choreographic structure, and the sound structure.
And
how they work in parallel lines, in opposition, or in different ways of working them against each other.
How did you conceive of the overall tapestry of Quarry?
what do you mean by that?
There's the dictator.
Right. I mean, how did I conceive of the whole piece? Or?
Yes. Did the whole come before the separate parts, or did you weave the different parts together?
I didn't get the whole in one sitting. Because I think when you have a piece that is as complex as this, it's really hard to get it in one sitting. I mean, sometimes you'll get a piece, you'll get something where you have an idea and you, in a sense, you see the whole thing, maybe in an hour or something like that. But this, it was still a putting together of a lot of elements into one overall structure. But in this piece, the thing that I felt good about was that I did have a sense of the whole. I definitely had a sense of the whole, and I definitely had a sense of what I was working for, because I had just finished Education of the Girl Child, which was a piece that followed Vessel, which was a very large piece that I did in 1971. And somehow, in Education of the Girl Child, I was pulling my scale down a lot, and I was working very much in terms of the people in the piece, more than I did in Vessel. Vessel was a piece where I was working with space as my primary element, and in that piece I did see the overall gestalt, and I was putting figures into it in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
But in Girl Child, I wanted to start more from the. I thought of it more as portraiture. I thought of Vessel more as landscapes, and I thought of Girl Child more as portraiture. But I was having a lot of trouble with the whole. I was having a lot of trouble with putting it together. It was very linear. It was very chunky kind of in its continuity. It had one section, and then there'd be another section, then there'd be another section. And I knew that what I had found in Vessel, but I hadn't somehow been able to integrate it. I hadn't been able to use it in Girl Child, because in a sense I was experimenting in Girl Child with other things. I was pulling down in, I was, you know, very much focusing in on the human element, mm-hmm. you know, and trying to get depth in that way.
What particular human elements were you trying to bring
in? Well, in Education of the Girl Child, of course, you know, it dealt with female identity and female archetypes, male and female archetypes within one sex. It was, you know, it was basically an all-woman cast. And it was, in a sense, trying to explore, I guess, the universe of both sexes within one sex. You know, it was a very monastic piece.
Do you say monastic because the cast was dressed so severely in white and had almost a puritanical, sort of Puritan look?
Well, no, I think of it more monastically because of the one sex, you know, and also because of somehow the sense of the of it being... well, a spiritual journey or something. I mean, it definitely had the sense of, it was, you know, spiritualized.
No, I can readily understand the spiritual journey because visually, the journey is really from, if you'll remember your performance, you were sitting in the chair as an old lady. And as you travel down the path singing, you became younger and younger.
Yeah.
So that in that sense, it's clearly a spiritual journey.
The solo was a time where I actually did, I got that solo, I saw that solo like in a flash. So that actually was an instance where I did see, I got the whole concept in a flash. And then it was, and somehow in a sense, in that piece particularly, it was set up. I saw the whole so much that I couldn't, in a way, I couldn't trespass it. I mean, I remember wanting to jump around and do more movement, and I remember complaining about not being able to do more movement. And somehow that road just set up its own laws that I had to, you know, I had to obey. You know, it set up its own integrity. There was no way I could break through that. You know, so in a sense, it was a matter of accepting. You know what had come to me or something. So that part had a very whole feeling. But then it was with the part with the other women, I think the problem with that, I mean, why it was so difficult was that the solo was set up as this really strong unit, and then somehow I knew that as in a structural sense, I didn't want it to have the same continuity as the solo. That it had to be another kind of way of looking at life. It was somehow that, to me, that solo was almost like a vertical. It was like looking at life in a vertical way. It was like one person's life in a very general way. And then somehow the group part was more as if you took slices. It was like it was almost horizontal. It's like you saw, it was like impressions and, you know, and little fragments and everything. You know,
yeah.
More a mosaic. Whereas, and in a sense, that was the... I think that was its strength, the way the two things went together, but in a sense that was the weakness structurally of the group part, and that was the thing that gave me a hard time, because it was hard for me to see the hole in that, in the group part.
Uh-huh. I mean, I can see, because the horizontal part, because the intermissions and everything had this vaudeville conclusion,
mm-hmm.
two people would come dancing
mm-hmm.
and tell you it was mm-hmm. time to,
mm-hmm.
you know, take a break
right.
or to come back, etc.
Well, they were kind of, I thought of them as almost framing devices, because I felt that it was getting a little, I felt that it was so solemn, it had such a weight or something, that it needed to have, you know, it needed to be framed in a way, and it needed to have a kind of lightness as a balance. I mean, I think in this work...
Inquiry?
Well, I think in all my work, that if I'm not just doing music piece, if I'm doing a solo music concert, I don't have to think about balance as much. But when I'm doing a piece that has a lot of elements, like the large theater pieces, or actually the theater pieces, it's always a matter of balancing out. It's always like the art form somehow demands always like an examination of balance. Balance is like a key word, because when you're dealing with a whole lot of elements and you are trying to weave them together into one form, that has its own integrity, where they're really woven into a form that, you know, is a unique form. You're always balancing one thing against another.
And although that's a general problem, for you, it it's a balancing of specific aspects of your work. That is, you have mime, dance, and music.
And words.
As well as
and
the
images.
Dramatic elements
right.
and visual staging.
Right. And that's why those big pieces usually end up taking a really long time for me to do. They take 2 years or something like that to really get together.
Is Quarry your first opera?
No. I think the first time I called a piece opera was Vessel. I called Vessel an opera epic because it was, it was an epic in scale, to say the least. It had about 80 people in it. And it started in my old loft on 9 Great Jones Street. And that was Vessel was a medieval piece. It was I used Joan of Arc as a kind of archetype. That was going to a female archetype that I felt very close to as a metaphor in a way of a person. In a sense, I felt like she was a metaphor of an artist in a way. It's always like this. I always hit on the same archetype over and over again. So I mean, I think everybody does that. You know, you keep on doing the same piece over and over again. I'll probably be doing the same piece over and over again. You know, it's always like that. The role of well, it has something to do with maybe being quiet and empty enough to receive. It's always the receiver or something that I'm examining, mm-hmm. or myself as a receiver or something, a transmitter or something. So in a sense, I saw Joan as like a woman who was able to listen to her information, whether it came from the gods or from herself. You know, which actually, in fact, is basically the same thing. I mean, it's like being able to hear that voice. Or your voices, and then take action on that, you know, somehow have the courage to take action on it.
It's funny because when you got the Obie this year, your joke was that you got it not for Quarry or anything else, but just as a gesture, you know, saying, let's keep this girl alive for the sake of the theater. So do you see yourself as the Joan? The old war horse. Well, there you have it, the metaphor for Joan of Arc. Do you see yourself sort of as Joan of Arc? Of what?
I really identified, you know, at that time anyway, I really identified with her because I was going through a lot of changes about, it was, you know, it was the late 60s, it was the early 70s, and I was going through a lot of changes, which I still go through, about somehow how you can maintain your, your spiritual growth in a basically, you know, commercial materialistic world. And even in sense of the artists in the society, you know, usually you think of the artist as maybe a person who transcends, you know, kind of the junk of the world, in a sense. But it's not true, because, I mean, even in the art field, it still has the same corruption and, you know, as any other. So, you know, it's always like that balance, because it seems that in the way this capitalistic society works, it to even be able to survive, you have to have a certain kind of aggressiveness and all the values that are kind of go against the other values of you know, making, of somehow growing, you know, internally and growing more tender and growing more compassionate and everything. So it's all, you know, that was, I was doing a lot of questioning about that and a lot of, at that time, a lot of rebelling and, so, you know, really a lot of rebelling about even being in the field at all. I mean, I was almost ready to just do something else. A lot of rebelling about, you know, appearing, a lot of rebelling about newspapers and, you know, like all the other, you know, stuff that happens in this city particularly. And so somehow to me, she was a person who was in a sense outside of the society. And somehow kind of thinking about how she would deal with certain situations gave me a lot of courage. I mean, it wasn't that, I don't feel like I'm the general of an army or anything. I mean, I see it more metaphorically or something.
This Joan of Arc image is Netta's ultimate victim?
Well, yes, of course. Then, after exploring that, then you know, after doing Vessel, I realized that, you know, I had really gotten myself into much hotter water than I thought I had, you know. And, I mean, I can remember...
Stakes.
Well, I can remember in Vessel, the last performance, it was raining. It was a Halloween night in 1971. And me standing at that electric organ, which I had found out after the show was over, that, you know, I could have been electrocuted. And, you know, and it raining, and us all, like, real cold. And I remember lying in the parking lot at the beginning of the piece going, okay, you know, you're really asked for it, you know. I mean, you can't fool around with things like this without the consequences.
So that
somebody screaming out of an apartment. I remember one night, and oh boy, I mean the things that went on, especially in that outdoor section of Vessel, were really amazing, like crazy, you know.
No, tell me about it.
Well, the one night, I think it was the night before the last night, we had just been videotaping the second part in the performing garage, and everybody was pretty, you know, videotaping is very hard for work like this that's complex, you know, and that's multi-imaged, you know, it's very hard for a camera, it's hard to deal with that on camera, because you've got to get simultaneous reality, and that's really hard to get on videotape. So all our nerves were a bit frayed, and we went, you know, we walked down to the parking lot to do that performance, and we got there, and first of all, there was no electricity. There was a little... There was a little house where they, I think they usually, you know, people that park there pay their money. And we had plugged in, that's what we used for our power source for the electric organ. Most of the lighting and the sound, I tried to really work with lighting that was not electric. Like I tried to use portable lighting. I mean, that was part of what I was experimenting with in that outside section, like using fire and using a sun gun light, which they use in film. It's a power pack, a battery pack, very harsh white light. But we did have the electric organ. That had to be plugged in, so we had these long extension cords. And we had, and then there was a section of the house, which was kind of a living room that had been converted from my 9 Great Jones Street living room, and all the furniture had been brought to the parking lot, so there was a lamp that had to plug in. So we got there, and there was no electricity. That was the first thing. So everybody was saying, let's cancel. I mean, it was about a half an hour before we were supposed to do the show, or, you know, 45 minutes. And there were about 10 motorcycles in the piece, and someone ran on their motorcycle. They went to get fuses. We were doing, you know, circuit breakers, everything. Someone went on a motorcycle to my loft and got every extension cord that any of us had in our lives. And we hooked into the next parking lot, which was a really long distance away. And so the piece started, everybody's lying on their back and they do this kind of humming thing, and the audience walked in, and then three people that have gray hair walk across the whole parking lot with a kerosene lantern, and then three men run across the whole parking lot and they have to yell, and then I'm supposed to play, and then there's a section of a narration that Lanny does that I do the hands to, and then I'm supposed to go back to the organ and start playing. I went back to the organ, no red light on the organ, and I went, oh no, something's the matter with the power. And so I just, you know, it was almost like drowning. Everything flashed through my mind in a split second. You know, could I do it without the organ? Could I sing all the organ parts? No, I went through every possibility, and then I said, no, we just, you know, that's all there, I just can't do it, you know, I'm not, you know, so I just stopped the piece, and I said to the audience, I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, we have no power, we have to start again. So we just, somehow, someone ran out of the audience, a friend of mine, and what happened was that someone had just kicked open the plug, basically, is what happened. And we started, you know, 75 people got back onto the parking lot, lay back on their backs again, started humming again. The three people with the gray hair started again. So, I mean, this gigantic thing went back into motion from the beginning. That was the first thing that night. Then I was singing, and I started hearing someone, like, screaming or sort of imitating my voice coming out of the building that was looking on the parking lot. That was the next thing. Then the next thing that happened that night was that one of the motorcycle people went to sleep, and he was in the truck. He went to sleep in a truck, and he didn't hear that he was supposed to... He heard the motorcycles, and then he realized that he had fallen asleep and that it was too late. That was the next thing that happened that night. And the last thing that happened was that... The very last image was a man with an acetylene torch, and everybody kind of runs after these motorcycles, and then I'm left on that great big parking lot by myself, and I do this kind of dance. It's almost like a moth going into a flame, back into that torch, and then I would stand there, and then at a certain point he would turn the torch off. That was the end of the piece. Well, I stood there and I stood there and I stood there. And the torch was still going, and it was still going. And I stood there, and I was going, Gary, Gary. I stood there 10 minutes had gone by. I'm going, Gary. I finally just walked. I just sort of, you know, I just walked off in complete disgust. And the acetylene torch was still going. We were all like outside of the parking lot, going, "What should we do? What should we do?" We all came in, took our bows, and the torch was still going. And then we all just walked off. The audience went home, and the torch was still going. And finally, I think he realized that a long time had gone by, and what had happened was that he had gotten a visor, he'd gotten a new helmet rather than using the goggles, and he couldn't see or hear anything. So that was that evening.
By contrast to that, how was the performance of Quarry.
Well, Quarry was, it's a lot. I mean, Vessel was almost out of hand, technically. I mean, when you're dealing with an outdoor space in New York City, you really have your hands full. You know, the police are coming through as you're rehearsing, and there were all these children in the piece, and they were running around. I mean, you know, you really are dealing with something, you know, when you're working outside. But Quarry, I mean, it was very tame in comparison, because we were in La Mama, which is basically a theatrical space, and I had really wonderful, wonderful technicians for the show that came from TAG, which is Technical Assistance Group, you know, just fine technicians. So, I mean, that was... I think the disasters were pretty tame in comparison to Vessel.
And so, Meredith, tell me, how did you get into the piece, started?
Well,
was it the girl child again, that image?
No, actually, I really kind of put up a big fight. I really didn't want to play that child. It somehow was by a process of elimination that I ended up... I wanted to play the dictator. I had my dictator character all worked out. The casting of Quarry actually was... giving me the most trouble. I did not see myself as the child at all. Actually, I had thought of a real child playing the child, but it just didn't work. It had to have a more focus, the ability to focus, I think, and also to be able to lie still all that time. I mean, that's very hard for a child to do.
Okay. And also the quality of the voice.
I needed the vocal strength. But that piece started about, I started thinking about it maybe about, well, maybe 2.5 years ago. Actually, I started thinking about it when I came back from Europe the first time, which was around 1972. And I was thinking about, it had been the first time that I had really been out of this country, except going to Peru. But, I mean, going to Europe, it was the first time I had gone to Europe. And I started thinking about, what that war... Well, I started thinking about actually both wars, the First World War and the Second World War. Like, what the world was like at a time when a phenomenon like that was existing, on the globe somehow. And also, I was thinking a lot about how each country dealt with that, with a phenomenon of that size, according to their national kind of temperaments, like how you would have that same phenomenon of fighting, and how, the French would improv, in World War I anyway, they were still fighting a sword battle. Mm-hmm. They thought it was a sword battle. They were wearing bright red pants and getting shot down, like flies. And, they felt that the spirit was everything and that they had to fight an offensive war. And somehow, they didn't realize for a while that they just had to dig in and, that, that spirit wasn't everything. It also had to do with planning. I mean, they felt that improvisation was the way that you fought a war. And that's, that was like the French spirit way of doing it. Somehow it amused me and it sort of interested me a lot. And then the Germans somehow had... for the First World War, they had had a plan that for 20 years, to the day, to the minute, to the hour, to the second of exactly what they were going to do, and that's exactly what they did do. But then once one thing went wrong, they couldn't adjust,
yes.
And then everything went wrong. And the British, came and kept on just kind of procrastinating about whether they were going to, be involved. And I know somehow that sense of that national spirit or something interested me a lot. And also, like, the battles interested me a lot, like the choreographic sort of aspect of it. I got really, sort of into my Mars, aspect. I started getting real interested. So that was about 2.5 years ago. And then I don't really exactly...
What about the Spanish element?
In this First World War? In the First World War? You mean the Spanish Civil War?
Yes.
Well,
because,
I didn't really start thinking
Quarry,
about. Yeah.
There's so many allusions to the Spanish aspect of it.
Well, actually, I didn't start thinking about the Second World War. I got interested in the First World War, and then I got interested in the Second World War, and then particularly because somehow I just, well, first of all, it's within my lifetime. I was a baby. My generation were babies,
mm-hmm.
And. Realizing somehow that, again, this was a phenomenon of magnitude that actually has, affected all of our generation in one way or another, that we lived with the myth of it or something. We didn't live with the reality of it, but we lived with the myth of it. And even people that are much younger have lived with the myth of it in a sense. And I think that's why there's an interest in it again. And then, of course, it was, in a sense, it's a way of understanding, like, my parents' generation more, what that was. So, I think like what Quarry ended up being, or what interested me about it was I knew that I, you know, from my own style of theater, I mean, I can't do documentary. That's not really, you know, I don't know how to do that. I don't really know how to do political theater, like, in a very overt way. And I'm not really too interested in it, because I'm not really interested in the topicality of it, or the, in a sense, the ephemeral quality of politics. I'm much more interested in, you know, in more universals or something, as far as, you know, this art, you know, the art is concerned. And somehow, because I do come from a sort of musical dance kind of background, you know, it has to be somehow transformed into a more poetic way of doing it. But what we were trying to do was, you know, deal with something. In a sense, it was a way of looking at World War II and through the unconscious or something. It was like an unconscious version, or a mythic version of it, or, you know, or a fantasy of it. So that somehow intrigued. I mean, it interested me a great deal, and also for me, it was in a way. I feel like every piece I do, or in a sense, I think almost every artist. Is they're basically dealing with identity. I think, like, that's, you know, what most artists are doing. They're dealing with identity in a sense. So in this piece, I was, and in a sense, they're affirming their identity. You know, it's a way of continuing to mine your, you know, to find out. It has to do with self-knowledge, you know, in a way, knowledge of the species. But in a sense, it was like some kind of affirmation, I think, of my Jewishness, which is something that I really, in a way, in my generation, again, didn't feel that close to, you know, coming from, I'm second generation, and my parents' generation, mostly those people, wanted to kind of forget, like, their roots. I mean, they wanted to be really assimilated into the United States. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we really didn't get a feel for it very much.
Were they victimized by the war?
Well, my mother was a singer. She was, in showbiz, and it didn't affect her at all. I think they were doing very well, as a matter of fact. The Depression, I don't think she knew existed, and, you know, and I don't think the war, in a way, they were doing fine. Radio was a big industry then, you know. She was a radio singer.
And your father?
My father was in the Seabees. He was a sailor. But he was old. He wasn't he was in his 30s or early 30s at that time, so he was not in battle. I mean, he was, you know, he was he and his brothers have been in the lumber business, and so that's what he was used for, you know, in Guam, you know, doing that supplies and, you know, all that building that the Seabees did in World War II. But anyway, I don't know. It was, for us, it was, for the whole group of people that were working on it, it ended up being really an amazing process, because somehow there were people like Lee Nagrin and Paul Vella, who are in their 40s now, so they actually had lived through, in a way, that period, and Lee particularly, it really changed her life. It had to do with a change of her consciousness. Somehow the reality, the seeing the newspapers and knowing, like, you know, that knowing the you know, that could exist or something, that kind of evil. It was also like, in a sense, you know, I think this piece, I mean, it has so many levels. It has a lot of layers, or at least in my mind it does. I don't know if when you see it does, but in the way I think about it, it has a lot of layers of you know, ways of hooking in, because in a way it was like dealing with evil. It was like looking at evil, and for me, it was really very scary because of that, because usually I think my work, in a sense, is almost utopian in a way. Like, and you know, it's like finding another solution. And this time it was like, in a way, going right in. It was like looking at reality with our eyes open, which was kind of scary for all of us.
So how did you resolve the problem of staging it?
Well, in a sense, I feel like this piece, again, it, in a way, it worked itself out a lot. And that was, I think, maybe the joy of the process of it. Because the rehearsals ended up being very exciting. I knew, as I said, that because of the structure of Girl Child, why I wasn't happy with that structure, that what I knew what I was looking for. I knew what I wanted to get back to, and I was somehow able to, at this time in my life, integrate again. This was really, like, I think Quarry for me was a real integration of many years of work, like 10 years of work, and a kind of, in a very concise form, that it did take place within an hour and a half. It wasn't 3 or 4 hours like Vessel was. And I knew that I wanted that musical structure. I knew that I wanted the tapestry, that sense of simultaneous time, that I didn't want like a linear, chunky, section-by-section time, that I wanted the whole thing to be woven. So I already, you know, had that kind of concept or a vision of it, you know, like from an early point. And so in a way, it you know, it seemed to work itself out. We didn't work on it. And also, I knew myself enough to know by this time anyway, or at least to be in control of myself enough to know that what we did was we worked a long time on the material, and I did not structure it right off the bat. In other words, I didn't use my editor right off the bat, because I could see that if I used that part of my mind too early, I'd cut off like what exists there. It's like needing to be in control too early or something of the flow of things. And I was real careful to just work on the material to really, you know, so that we all really enjoyed working on the material under no pressure to put it together somehow. And then at a certain point, it was time to put it together.
Do you want to describe for the listening audience how you finally staged it at La Mama? We should describe the space. It's a vast space.
It's a space the size of a basketball court, basically. It's a long, narrow... It's not that narrow. It's about 90 feet long, and it's about 50 feet wide, I would say. Very beautifully proportioned. It's it has kind of the proportions of a gym, basketball court kind of.
It was a gym, wasn't it? It's an old high school or something.
It could have been. I heard that it was a place that where they had weddings and weddings or banquets or something.
Before the Second World War.
Before the Second World War.
But it's a very, very handsome space.
The proportions are very beautiful. It's got quite a high ceiling. I think about 20 feet. And the way that they have the seating now is vertical seating, scaffoldings on the two long sides of the space. So the audience is looking from two sides, which is something, one of the reasons why I chose that space. I made the piece with that space in mind. I don't know where else I would have done it. I mean, I would like the idea of the audience being able to see each other. I like the idea of seeing a mass of being, of human beings across from you as part of what you're seeing. Mm-hmm. Because of that sense of, that you could transform that place into like a rally or, into that, The thing that's beautiful about that space is that it has, it's very a curious space because it has that epic, it has the thing where you can work in an epic scale. But at the same time, what's very beautiful is that the audience is sitting close enough that you can also work very intimately. Mm-hmm. So it's got the two things simultaneously. And again, for me, that was a real integration because that was because I seemed to veer between really working very large or pulling way down in scale. And somehow being able to work those two realities simultaneously for me was, really wonderful.
Mm-hmm. So that the size was ideal. It created the illusion of a stadium, but still...
But you could see every face, you could see every detail.
Yeah. And so how, do you want to tell the audience how you actually staged the thing?
Sure. I thought of that piece as I thought of it as a mandala. I thought of it as a very symmetrical, I just thought of it like a mandala, like you were looking down. I thought of it almost like one of those Buddhist mandalas where you have like, the thing in the center and you have like all these demons on the outsides.
Revolving.
I mean, I thought of it as circular, circular. And so what I have is, I have the child, who is in a sense like the visionary character or something, the person that's experiencing the piece or seeing the piece or something, or seeing what's going on, the seer or something like that, in the center on a bed. And actually the audience pretty much, there are two levels. Some of the people are looking from way up above and some people are looking from a little above, but it's pretty much the experience of looking down on a piece. So I thought of the floor as like the canvas. I basically thought of the floor of the space as the backdrop. And then I had the child with a quilt over her, and so you were looking down. It was, the quilt was right on the floor, so you were really looking. It was as if it was an overhead shot of a bed. And then on the four corners are like, well, I think of them as four different realities or four different countries or four different glimpses at human beings that existed during one phenomenon or during one time. Although you can't, now that myself, I do these pieces and then even after they're done I'm also seeing things about them too. There's again like I'm going, oh, I did, I did, oh, that's what that is, or something like that. I think that always happens too. And I think you can look at them as, I had thought about them as, first I thought about having four different countries, But now I see that actually all four of them, in a sense, do have a relationship to the child, but they don't. But they still can be simultaneous. I mean, it could be read that it's like, you know, the mother, the grandparents, you know, siblings or aunts or cousins, or and then the ancestors. I mean, that's the way you can look at it. Or it can be, you know, Lanny, you know, in America, and Paul and Lee in Europe, and you know the, you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
You can look at it that way, too.
So that it could either be time or space,
right,
in the four corners.
Right. So that's sort of the basic, like, those are the grounded elements. And then those, like, the little sets for those corners, because each little corner has, like Lanny Harrison, who plays the mother, or the woman with the red coat is what I call her, has, like, her little dressing table and a rug. There are also rugs or... there's linoleum on one corner, again, as a grounding device, because when we tried to do them without the rug, it was as if each of those corners went into the air. It needed to have like something like a rectangle, so that when you were looking from above, it was framed. Otherwise, it didn't work. It seemed like they were suspended off the floor or something. It was really mm-hmm. interesting to work on visual. I mean, spatially, it was really, the problems that presented themselves were really interesting. That overhead, how to deal with the overhead view of things, and how to perform up, you know, at the same time without, you know, being too stylized about it.
Were the performers actually eventually looking towards the...
Well, we were very much aware of... Not necessarily. It was just that you had to be aware that you had to keep yourself open. In other words, that every time you put your energy down to the floor, you were closing off. You know, in other words, you had to have the sense that you were open to, like, the ceiling, and you were open to the tiers of the audience, and you were open to all four sides of you. You know, which was really interesting as a performer, but not, you know, being exaggerated about it, but just not to close off. You know, because every time you closed off, you weren't including everybody, especially the people up at the top, you weren't including.
So that must have changed the performance a lot when you actually went into that
space. Oh, yes. Well, we were working in my loft, which is really small, and, you know, it looked great in my loft. Then we got into the space, and it was just really amazing. You know, we were a little on the discouraged side for about a day. Because, first of all, the sound in La Mama is a hard thing to deal with. It's not any resonance at all. It was a television studio. And Ellen Stewart did it really as much as she could to let there be a... she really worked hard to get there to be some resonance in that room by putting tin on the walls. I mean, she really did that single-handedly, transform that space. I mean, I think her back still hurts from, you know, carrying up those, aluminum. But nevertheless, the ceiling is padded. I think it would be an enormous expense to change that. And so you have, like, a really flat sound. And it's very hard vocally, very, very difficult. And in my loft or in the rooms that we rehearsed, I mean, there was a natural resonance. So the people that in the chorus who are all have very beautiful voices, I mean, suddenly they were in this big space and you hardly could hear them. And I was kind of heartbroken about it. And it ended up being that we had to we had to hang a lot of microphones and amplify, but to a very small degree, because I hate the sound of an amplified theater piece. I hate it. But I mean, we just did it very delicately, and Tony Giovanetti, who was our sound person, did a very beautiful job making it so that you really didn't hear that it was amplified. But I mean, it just had to help people out, because you would sing and the note was over before you had, you know, you began. It was so flat, there was no decay at all, none. So that was a hard adjustment, you know, and the space too, because I mean, you know, working in a smaller space, it feels like those four corners are more linked up, and when you're farther away, you've got to still get that kind of connection, that the energy is connected, even though it's four different realities. You want to have that sense of the whole.
So what happened to the performing style?
Well, it got a bit, it got bigger.
Looser,
you know, slightly.
Bigger,
yeah, it had to be
four
bigger.
Four-dimensional.
Yeah, it had to, it had to be much more, yeah, it had to be, and in a sense, it got bigger and it got simpler. That's what happened to it.
Huh. Why simpler?
Because all the little... movements, all the little, like, say, particularly in the trio section, the three women eating at the card table, Gail Turner, Mary Schultz, and Monica Mosley, they were doing, like, basically they were doing natural activity, and we had to keep on stripping that down. We had to, because every time there was, like, a lot of small gesture where, you know, that was not, somehow didn't have a force to it, it just was almost like seeing people babbling or something, or... You know, it was like, it just didn't read. It was just like mush or something.
You had to reduce everything to an essential.
Yeah, everything had to be really simplified.
Literal gesture.
Well, very clear. Yes. It had to be very clear.
And
essential, very essential.
So that the piece must have changed completely between rehearsal and opening.
Well, it didn't change completely, because I think that it the flow somehow was, you know, I think the structure of it held very strong. You know, when we did get the structure, you know, it seemed to hold. It seemed to have its own reality or something. So that didn't change at all. But I think, like, some of the material within, like, the large structural units changed. And the timing changed. The timing, especially in the beginning, between the four corners, that changed a lot. And I'm not 100% happy with it yet. I still would like to work with it some more.
It changed. It became faster.
Well, it became faster. It became that people would have to stop. And it became that because, again, like, the space was large, for the audience to take that in, it became that the audience couldn't take in four simultaneous things without, you know, craning their necks and moving a mile a minute. And so it became that the only way that it seemed like it could work is that it was almost like one thing at a time. And that's a thing that I wasn't very happy with. And in a way, I'm still debating whether I don't really mind, you know, people craning their necks and, you know, just not catching everything. You know, because somehow, philosophically, I like the idea better that it's like four realities and you get what you get rather than having to stop and say, okay, now we're looking at this corner and then everybody else is kind of doing little things or almost nothing and now you get a chance to look at that corner. I mean, I don't know. I don't like the way that feels, because what we're trying, I mean, I don't like the way that, philosophically, I don't like the way that feels. I don't know what it is to look at it.
I know. Your concept goes in the other direction. The concept would go, activity.
Yeah.
In time and space.
Yeah, it would be as if you were looking in four apartments at the same time or something.
I'd like very much to sort of have you tell us about your musical training. Did you begin with music or dance?
Well, my mother's family are all musicians. It's always crazy because people ask me this, and I always have to explain it this way. But I think that's the way it's got to be explained, because that's the relationship or something. My mother's family are all musicians, and that goes back like four generations. And somehow it's really a thing that's taken for granted in that family. You know, it's just taken for granted. And I think my great grandfather was a cantor. That's what I heard about a week ago or 2 weeks ago. And my grandfather was a singer in Russia and a violinist and had a music conservatory here in New York in Harlem. And my mother was a singer. So like that just it was passed down. And I think that she, you know, it was, as I say, it was taken for granted that I was going to be able to have this musical ability like very early, and at the same, which is a pressure on a certain level. But on the other side of that. I was given music very early. I mean, I know that she would sing, at least this is what she said. I mean, she'd be singing to me all the time. And I picked up very fast. So, like, I was singing back things. Like, it must have been some kind of, I know, I can see that it must have been some kind of pressure in her mind, though, you know, which, you know, that was that we were supposed to be, like, these really great musicians or something. And so I'm sure I was tested. Like, you know, as an early child, real early, because what I heard was, you know, just from hearing that information, you can tell, like, what was in their minds, you know, that I was singing back melodies very fast, like 8 months, 9 months, singing back, like, what was sung to me, like I was singing it back. That was before talking, so that function, like, was very early, and that my, you know, and rhythmic patterns and stuff like that, very early. And as far as my, I think, like, I don't think I was a particularly physical, like, really young child. And I think and that must have disturbed my mother in one way or another. I absolutely have no idea why. And so I think that what she figured was that, you know, that I somehow, that music was an easy language for me. And so it would be nice to go to dancing school. But the dancing school that she chose was Dal Crozier Rhythmics, which is a real integrated concept of dance and music, which was a really good choice. There were wonderful teachers that were teaching who were called the Ram sisters. One is Mita Ram, who's dead now, and the other teacher who was my teacher was Lola Ram, who, you know, worked with very small children.
How old were you?
I was about three.
3 years old?
3 years old.
And you were singing and dancing?
I was singing. I was singing. I know I was singing. Dancing, I mean, I think those classes were things like skipping to rhythm. And I mean, it was, it's rhythm work. And I can remember, you know, those little tunics and everything. And so, like, that, I did that my whole childhood. So as far as which came first, dancing or music is concerned, I would say actually music did.
And because that's a language for you.
Because that's basically a real language for me. And that dancing, the training was pretty early, because three is pretty early, and that was something that I wanted to do a lot. And it was some, in a way, it was, in my family structure, it was a way of having, like, my own territory, in a sense. But I think that, and I always loved to dance, but I think that it was harder for me. But I think, in a sense, that was also a thing that interested me about it, that was very challenging. Whereas music, I felt I was very lazy about it, and I took piano lessons very young, and theory and all that stuff really young, and I'd never practice, and I'd come in and sight read my lesson and just be kind of, you know, very lazy about it, about music, not work at it very much. But dancing I did work at really hard. So in a sense, like, my training, I actually have more formal training in dance than I do in music. You know, because I didn't really go and seek musical training, in a sense. I somehow took that for granted. Now, sometimes I wish that I had more training in a way. I mean, I know theory. I did have theory and harmony. I was writing music early, like around 16. You know, I was writing these little pieces. But sometimes I feel like I wish I had more training, like that I had really gone through music conservatory and everything. But sometimes I don't at all. I just feel like... I like being able to really just trust my ear as it is, or something, or somehow learn myself and treat it as a language somehow, and not have to go through, like, what the rules are or something, go through what the rules that have existed historically are.
Which brings us to the most interesting point. Some people have heard you sing classical style, and other people have never heard you sing classically. And when did you begin going from harmonics into atonal music in your singing?
The thing about music, again, like, all, it was a crazy kind of thing, because, as I say, I wasn't really going and seeking it out, but it would be always this kind of thing. Like, in high school, I remember taking, you could take one elective that wasn't an academic, and I remember having to take typing or something and dying and being real mad about it and hating it and failing it and everything, and somehow, like, hearing the chorus and sort of tiptoeing in and sight-reading real fast. I was always a very fast sight-reader, and, you know, just being always pulled in somehow, always, you know, I mean, always like that, that's where I belonged, you know, it's really where I belonged. And so when I was even in college, I was at Sarah Lawrence, and I was doing, dance was my major, which is a wonderful program. I mean, it's, you are taking technique classes and you're doing composition. I was doing a lot of composition, and somehow the way that school works, I think they have the program is really, in a sense, tailored to each person, what their needs are. So I was trying to get some singing coaching in there, and I did finally, like, my junior year, I was doing, like, one singing lesson a week just to be singing again, and then finally in my senior year, I was taking a combined performing arts program where I actually was singing every day, and I was doing opera workshops. So I was getting back in, you know, I was doing real classical training again. I had done a little bit, you know, I'd sort of gone to my mother's singing lesson, you know, every once in a while, dragged myself there, and, you know, I just couldn't stand it. Again, very impatient. I was very impatient with it. But somehow at Sarah Lawrence, the opera workshop was wonderful. It was taught by, it was a combined class. It was taught by Bessie Schoenberg, who was the head of the dance and theater program there, who's just an extraordinary teacher and a person that I have, a great deal of gratitude for. And, you know, I just feel like she was a very influential for me. I mean, she gave me a great deal of encouragement and, you know, a lot of support, and somehow saw, I think, like, in a way, like, what I was trying to get at that time. And then and she was dealing with it from a movement standpoint, the staging of opera. And then Paul Yukina, who is a wonderful singer, was doing it really from the vocal standpoint. So that was really exciting. That was very exciting for me. And my voice at that time wasn't really... I mean, I always was very musical. My voice had not matured, actually, by age 20. It was still a very light voice, very light. I mean, pure as far as pitch was concerned and intonation, but light. And then I actually didn't start, you know, it didn't really mature until I was about 20, 23 or 24, and that was after I was out of school, and I had had somehow this vision of dancing and singing at the same time, which I felt like, and I tried doing all these experiments with it, and I somehow couldn't figure out how to do it, and I think actually I wasn't strong enough vocally. I did a few little pieces like that when I was at Sarah Lawrence singing and dancing, but I'd get terribly, terribly nervous about singing. I would just completely fall to pieces when I would perform in singing. I don't know why it was at that time. Especially classical. I mean, it's I still, when I did the recital about 2 years ago, well, I'll tell you that story after I go through the process before that, but I was terribly nervous. And finally, like around when I was about 23 or 24, I started singing. I put some singing into a piece called 16 Millimeter Earrings, which was really the way I got back to the voice again. And then I started really working with the voice. And I started doing all these exercises. Some of them were my all classical exercises. But I somehow had some kind of concept, or it hit me, you know, very suddenly about the voice as an instrument and the voice as a moving instrument, like a you know, the voice like a hand or a foot or,
yes,
you know, or texture,
yeah,
or that it had the flexibility, the impulses that you could have, the voice could have the kind of impulses that you have in movement, you know, that it, you didn't have to be, you know, that it was an energy source or something like that. That was a terrific revelation. I remember the day very well. I was in Woodstock and I was sitting at the piano and I just kind of went doing, you know, it was like really one of those things that happen, you know, once in your life or twice at the most, or three times.
So when did you start singing in the style that people now identify with you?
That piece, that was in 1967. That was, I had used, as I said, I did some of the singing in 16 millimeter earrings. That was still pretty, stylistically, it was a, repetitious sort of, ostinato kind of phrasing and everything. But as far as the vocal technique was concerned, it still was pretty smooth, you know, what I call smooth singing. It was still pretty, like, vibrato and, you know, like, pretty, you know, supported and everything in a certain way. But in this next piece, which was called Blueprint, which I did in 1967, you know, after that summer of work, I did, like, you know, use the voice in you know, very plastic and, you know, very, you know, painterly and, you know, kinetic way. And I did, in that piece, I did like a kind of duet with my cousin, Daniel Zellman, who's an engineer. He was playing an Echoplex, which is an echo chamber device. So it was, we basically were doing a duet, and, you know, and it was very free singing. I mean, it was really free singing. And from that time on, you know, it just was working with a voice. That was the breakthrough for me around 1967.
Was it a breakthrough or a turning against?
I think it was a breakthrough more. I see it, you know, the way that I saw it in my mind, I think at that time was more an expansive, you know, it had a feeling more of expansion rather than a, you know, a negation or something.
Mm-hmm.
And the recital a few years ago, Roots, that came from my friend Donald Ashwander, who's a wonderful keyboard player, plays piano beautifully and electric instruments. He's the person that does the music for the Paper Bag Players. And I had just finished, we kind of supported each other to get our albums out. Like, I had just finished doing Our Lady of Late, finally, after a lot of, anguish and everything about whether I was going to do it on a commercial label or whether I was going to get the money together, scrape it together, and, you know, put it out myself. So finally, I finished that, and he finished his record, which was called Turnips, and we pressed them ourselves and everything. And so the recital was, in a sense, a kind of a celebration. It was like a party for ourselves and our friends, you know, for, like, the completion of those albums. And it also was, he went to Manhattan Music School, and he's a ragtime pianist from way back. You know, he comes from Alabama. I mean, he really, and, you know, he was doing his senior recital and was in the middle of Beethoven and you know, completely blanked out and finished in Rhapsody in Blue or something like that. And, you know, that's what he did in Manhattan School of Music, you know. I mean, he completely blanked and improvised ragtime or something in the middle of a Beethoven sonata. So, you know, it was kind of a way of him, you know, doing this classical recital was comparable to me, you know, trying to sing classical stuff when I was in college and completely freaking out and in complete nerves. So in a way it was, I think, in a sense it was trying to see if we could do it now, you know, mature artists or something, go through that same. And also in a way it was, I mean, it came from me going over there and really loving to sing those things, you know, singing through a lot of stuff. And that those were pieces that we both really loved.
Mm-hmm.
And
tell
it was
me
a
which
sharing.
Pieces you sang, because I don't recall.
I sang a Ravel piece that's called, it's one of the chansons grecques, which is called Quel Galant. I sang a Schütz wedding song, which I was supposed to sing at a wedding when I was about 20 and the person never got married, so that was that. I sang a Satie piece, a wonderful music hall piece. I sang the Bach Bist du bei mir. I sang a piece of Donald's called The Locust, which is a very beautiful piece. I sang my own piece that's called Do You Be. and I sang Purcell's Dido and Aeneas, Dido's Lament, which is one of the most beautiful things written for the voice in the English language. So that was, you know, it was. We did it in the afternoon, and it had a very nice feeling of inviting people over, and you know, it was a gift, you know. And then what I did was I choreographed some dances to those same pieces. He played the piano scores without the voice, so in a sense, it was the body became like the vocal line. And then I did those pieces. So I basically, what I did was I sang the pieces and then I danced the pieces. And that was, in a sense, a kind of... The piece was called Roots, and it was Roots because I hadn't choreographed to anybody else's music or really actually choreographed to music, you know, for 10 years or something. So it was going back to a discipline that I, you know, hadn't done in 10 years of going to the studio, listening to the music, you know. I mean, I just don't work that way. I don't actually work to music.
How do you work?
I just really work rhythm? From the movement itself, you know, and then the score is like, you know, it's more like simultaneous or something rather than working off the music, you know, as far as finding music, as far as finding movement is concerned. You know, and I still, you know, my question still is, you know, what exactly do you do to box? So my answer to that was, well, I think I stood there, I laid down on the floor, I stood back up, and then I sang the rest of Bach. I mean, I didn't even attempt, I ended up not even attempting to do a dance to the Bach. That was the last piece in that afternoon, and I was very, very simple about it. But it was interesting, you know, to go back to that, because that's actually what a choreographer usually, you know, that's actually what the process usually is.
Do you think that it would have been possible for you to find your direction anywhere outside of New York? Because, you know, you're such a strong part of the development of the arts in New York in the 60s, especially of performance,
mm-hmm.
with all of its eclectic elements
mm-hmm.
used.
Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think that... Are you asking if I had, say, been out of New York, would I have done the same thing? Or are you saying... Is that what you're
yes.
asking? Oh my goodness! That's hard to tell, because I know that the roots of you know what I'm doing now really began, you know, in Sarah Lawrence. So I mean, I wasn't in New York at that time, and that in a sense it was you know, like a
You were how many miles from New York?
Half an hour. I was half an hour
from
New York.
New York.
I wasn't in New York. Oh God, that's a hard question. I think that's...
Then let me reverse
the
question.
Well, I could give you sort of an answer, because I think that the reverse of that question is that basically what it ends up being, this work, what it ends up being is that it is, it's a necessity in a sense because of my nature. It's a necessity because of the fact that I did have, like, you know, these multiple interests. And if I still do have the multiple interests, it's a necessity as an integration of myself, you know, it's an integration of, like, you know, into one person.
Thank you, Meredith Monk.
The previous program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.